months after the killing that the Georgia Bureau of Investigation stepped in and made arrests. She says the killers had to be held accountable, and Arbery's family would not give up.
It shows others what you can do when you band together and take action. Don't just accept the okey-doke, as they used to say. Band together, seek the truth, and stay strong.
Shortly after the judge read the verdicts, Jason Artiste knelt on the grass by the courthouse steps in prayer. Local clergy laid hands on his shoulders.
I just felt led to pray at that time because it's a crucial moment in our culture, I think the nation's history.
Artiste drove up from Jacksonville, Florida for the day. He says he was moved by Arbery's family's strength.
Really, the most important part to me was to see some of the relief on the face of the family, the grieving family. I think that gets missed. It's not just a trial about race or culture or ideology. It's a family that lost someone.
Standing with Arbery's parents, Wanda Cooper Jones and Marcus Arbery, on the courthouse steps, the Reverend Al Sharpton noted that for them, this will be a somber day of thanks.
There will be an empty chair at Wanda's table.
Yes.
Ahmed would not be at Thanksgiving, but she can look at that chair and say to Ahmed, I fought a good fight.
Yeah, come on.
And I got you some justice.
Yeah.
The journey is not over. Arbery's killers will go on trial early next year for federal hate crimes. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Brunswick, Georgia.
John Perry joins us next. He's a senior pastor of Mount Sinai Missionary Baptist Church in Brunswick, Georgia, and he joined the Arbery family during the trial. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. Good morning to you and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, sir. Debbie Elliott's report included a description there of a T-shirt that said, Justice Served. Was it?
Yes, it was. It was a breathtaking moment. As a community leader, one of the things that we did was really encourage our community, let's go through this process the right way. And so when the verdict was given, it was literally breathtaking. A lot of weight lifted off of my shoulders as a leader, encouraging people to maintain peace in such a hostile event that took place here within our community.
When you say hostile event, do you mean the attack itself, the murder itself, or the way the wider community responded to those who wanted justice?
Well, the attack primarily. It was a gross act of violence that we're not really accustomed to here as a community. And then the absence of an arrest immediately caused people within the community to be outraged. And so, you know, initially it took some doing to get everyone calm and get everyone on that same page of pursuing justice the right way.
Let's remind people about that. This was a killing that was little noticed at the time, and there were not initially charges. And then after a little while, a video was leaked that gave people some idea of what really had happened there. And then authorities stepped in, and then charges were filed, and then a trial proceeded. When you look back on all of that, would you say the system worked?
Well, the Ahmaud Arbery killing revealed to us that we had a lot of work to do within our local system. It was impossible to project that the McMichaels would do such a heinous act. And you can never predict when an individual is going to assault another individual. But if that does happen, you're depending on your local justice system to step in and to make it right. In our case, there was no arrest made. Literally, we waited over 70 days for there to be an arrest made. And that arrest that was made, it had to happen from state officials because our local officials at the time were not willing to do the job that taxpayers put them in place to do.
Have local officials acknowledged that maybe they should have approached this case differently?
Well, we've had different individuals from within different divisions to make statements of regret or sympathy, but holistically, we never got a statement from our county commissioners who oversee the county police department. Now, the citizens did rally together to make significant changes as a result of the things that happened in the Ahmaud Arbery case. We have a new chief of police now. Two of the county commissioners that served at that time were upseated. And so we're seeing some positive changes as a result of this because the community has been awakened and recognized that they have to be a part of the process.
We just got about a minute left, but I want to end with Ahmaud Arbery himself. In a couple of sentences, for those who didn't know him, what was he like?
Well, my son played football with Ahmaud Arbery, and one of the statements that he told me initially when he found out, he said, "Dad, what are you all going to do about this?" Because he was a good young man. He encouraged everyone around him and always was someone that would put a smile on the face of others, had a wonderful sense of humor. And so the idea that they would taint the narrative of this young man's life by saying that he was committing a burglary was outright unthinkable.
Pastor John Perry of Brunswick, Georgia, it's a pleasure talking with you on this Thanksgiving morning. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Michelle Butler of Utah, Alabama, doesn't have to think too hard to know what she's grateful for this Thanksgiving. Many of her family members are getting to meet her son, Curtis, for the first time.
It's going to be real special because this is going to be Curtis' first year home with us for Thanksgiving.
Curtis and his twin sister were born 4 months premature in July.
Curtis was 15 ounces at birth, and his sister, Ciaja, was 14 ounces at birth.
Doctors said their chance of survival was less than 1%. His sister died, but he survived.
That makes Curtis officially the most premature baby to survive, according to Guinness World Records, who came to present a certificate naming him as the world's smallest baby. Curtis was on a ventilator for 3 months, and he stayed in the ICU at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, for 275 days.
The 9 months, it was like, I seen him grow outside of my womb. It was just like, wow, this was supposed to grow inside of me, but actually he's growing inside of a hospital.
Curtis was finally discharged in April.
It was exciting to actually bring him home, and my kids only seen him on Zoom, so it was just like, now my family is complete. Yes, he is very busy.
He still uses a feeding tube and supplemental oxygen, although Michelle says the doctors will start weaning him from both soon.
I hook up a machine, like an IV line pump thing, to his stomach, and it pumps the food into his stomach because he's not eating by mouth as of yet. And Curtis is on oxygen on a half a liter.
It's been hard, but you take the pleasure where you can. Curtis beat the previous Guinness World Record by just 24 hours. Michelle has the plaque on display in her living room.
I'm very proud of it.
Happy Thanksgiving, Curtis.
Hold your eyes full of possibility, like a sky wide open and blue. I know you're on your way. I can't wait to meet you. Brand new curtains for the window, and a blanket in baby blue that your grandmother started working on the second that she heard you'd be here soon. And we'll all be watching over you as you take your first breath. We count the minutes and the hours until the day.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hannah Haynes in for Melissa Ingalls today. Coming up, Thanksgiving myth tells us that the Pilgrims survived because friendly Native Americans helped them adapt their farming practices. Since then, it's been Native people who've been forced to adapt. More on Native food traditions in 15 minutes.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at WPR.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Downtown Action Council, reminding listeners that local small businesses in downtowns across Wisconsin are open and stocked for holiday gift shopping. Info is at wisconsindowntown.org.
Support comes from Kenosha County ADRC. Kenosha County Western Transit now offers Saturday and Sunday demand service from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Fares are $5 one way for the general public and $3 for older adults or persons with disabilities. For reservations, call 888-203-3498.
In the weather forecast, it'll be chilly today. Afternoon temperatures in the 30s and breezy winds continue with gusts between 20 to 30 miles per hour. Tomorrow, temperatures are dropping overnight, frigid temperatures in the morning, with morning lows ranging between the upper single digits in the far north and the upper teens in the far south. Afternoon highs may struggle to reach the upper 20s to mid 30s across Wisconsin. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sattva, offering mattresses made with eco-friendly materials and handcrafted construction, delivered with setup and old mattress removal included. More at SAATVA.com. From Athena Health, creating connected healthcare technology designed to improve patient outcomes and increase efficiency of healthcare practices and organizations. Learn more at athenahealth.com. And from Charles Schwab, with a variety of financial planning options, from online tools to meeting with a financial consultant, Schwab works to make it easy to plan for tomorrow, today. More at schwab.com/plan.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. We've all heard about how supply chain disruptions are affecting all kinds of goods, right? Furniture, clothes, toys, computer chips. And it pains me to say this, but books are on that list too. WBEZ's Greta Johnson found that the publishing industry is on edge this holiday season.
Sandra Law has a lot of worried clients right now.
Definitely a lot of emails from customers. Where are my books? Where are my books?
Law is the Midwest sales rep for Abraham Associates, which represents more than 30 small publishers. She says there are supply chain issues at practically every step of the bookmaking process. There's a paper shortage. There's a glue shortage. Law says 98% of the books we read here in the U.S. are printed in China. So even if a publisher can find a printer overseas and they can find paper and all the books get made, the publisher still needs a shipping container.
It's a little wild. Shipping containers used to only cost around $2,500. Now some publishers are having to spend upwards of $25,000. Definitely as like a publisher operations person, oof, it's just not the time to have that job.
There aren't as many mills as there used to be. They've all shut down. They're going bankrupt. They're retooling for diapers. And everybody knows about the ships that are off the coast of California right now and off the coast of Boston. It's real.
That is Clark Matthews. He's the vice president and general manager of IPG Inc., a book distributor and printer based in Chicago. At IPG, there's a giant room with industrial paper cutters, conveyor belts, massive rolls of paper, and huge printers.
Oh, I see a red light. That's probably not good, huh?
Red light is no good. In the bowels of this machine, an important belt broke, and that important belt cannot easily be replaced.
Is that partly because supply chain?
Yes. Our technician is going to another site and stripping an existing machine somewhere else of that part and putting it on this machine.
Because of all these issues, Matthews has found as many logistical redundancies as he can.
My supply chain is stronger now than it's ever been because I've got a plan B and a plan C for everything.
And booksellers are also trying to think about their plans B and C, especially now as people start buying gifts for the holidays.
It's going to be an issue for sure. Don't ignore it.
Javier Ramirez co-owns and runs Exile in Bookville, an indie bookstore in Chicago. Only about half of the shop sales come from new books. They sell used books, too. So he thinks he'll be safer from shortages than the stores that rely only on shiny new releases.
I think it's those big titles, you know, the Sally Rooney's and the Colson Whiteheads and Jonathan Franzen's. I think that's where bookstores are going to be impacted.
Now, of course, if you have your heart set on the new Colson Whitehead, you could download an audiobook or an ebook. But someone who waits till the last minute to do any holiday shopping is definitely going to feel the impact.
Somebody's going to walk in looking for a gift for their uncle who loves military history, nonfiction, and he's going to get a book on how to press flowers, you know?
So essentially, customers are going to have a plan C too. And who knows, maybe instead of the history of the Panzer tank, Uncle Dave will get into pressing pansies. So when shopping for the book nerd in your life, be flexible about what books you're giving this holiday season. And if you unwrap a book you weren't expecting, hey, flower pressing is kind of awesome. For NPR News, I'm Greta Johnson.
People feeling burned out at work are not alone. A recent survey of workers in more than 40 countries found that more than 60% of them reported they felt burned out often or very often during the pandemic. Research shows that workplace burnout poses a serious risk to mental health. So our Life Kit team asked how you can know when you're burned out and what to do when you are. In this encore presentation, NPR's Ritu Chatterjee has some tips.
Work was relentless in 2020 for Diane Ravigal. She's an EMT in California.
I work 24-hour shifts. Just the way that it falls, I'll work anywhere between 2 to 3 24-hour shifts in a 7-day period.
After an especially busy summer, Ravigal hit a wall.
It was an overwhelming set of feelings where I wasn't making the right decisions. I was beyond exhausted, physically, mentally, emotionally.
Then she began to doubt herself.
I started to question myself, like, man, like, can I do this? Can I do this for the rest of my life? Can I do this every day?
That kind of self-doubt is part of the burnout experience, says psychologist Christina Maslach.
Thinking, what has gone wrong with me? Why am I not good at this? Why can't I handle it?
Maslach is at the University of California, Berkeley, and has studied burnout for decades. She says exhaustion is also a symptom.
You're tired, you can't focus, it's hard to get up in the next morning and go back to work.
Then she says people also start to feel cynical about work.
It's kind of take this job and shove it, you know, sort of thing.
But it can be hard to recognize you're burned out when you're in the middle of it. Dr. Jesse Gold is a psychiatrist at Washington University in St. Louis.
One of the things that I tell people is trying to pause and take almost like an inventory of how you're doing.
If you find yourself feeling exhausted, angry, irritable, or stressed often, chances are you're burnt out. Gold says it can help to check in with your mood multiple times each day.
Well, every time I have a meeting with so-and-so, I feel horrible. And then every time I'm with this person or doing this thing, that's where I find most meaning.
She says find ways to make little changes to your workday to make it less stressful. Maybe skip those meetings you hate. If you can't do that, Gold says, maybe do something you really enjoy right after the meetings.
We can rearrange our day to have some positives with some negatives, so it's not a horrible day of just negative.
This is important, she says, because a lack of control at work is a factor for burnout, as is working too much. So even short bursts of rest can help.
And so taking that 5 minutes in an hour or one day a week to your ability to recuperate is going to be a big part of dealing with that exhaustion.
Dr. Gaurava Agarwal is a psychiatrist and a well-being coach at Northwestern Medicine.
Once we have our tanks refilled a little bit more, we have the ability to face the ongoing stressors moving forward.
And for people working from home right now, Jesse Gold says, have clear boundaries between work and personal life. Wake up at the same time, shower, get dressed, have a clear beginning and end to your workday.
This really allows your brain to think like, this is work, this is life. I can have both and distinguish between the two. And that can allow me to have like enjoyment in my day-to-day life as well.
Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
To hear more about fighting burnout, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
400 years after what's considered the first Thanksgiving meal, the tribe that received the pilgrims is fighting to reclaim its story.
It's become a time for us to really be activists, to remind people that, yes, there are still Mashpee Wampanoag people living in Mashpee, Massachusetts.
I'm Audie Cornish. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition here on WPR. In news, there's a project underway in northeastern Wisconsin to restore 76 acres of rare oak savanna. We'll hear more from WPR's Megan Hart following a news update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Security is high for the 2.5-mile Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade now underway in New York City. Will Koss is executive producer of the event.
We have a variety of security measures that are taking place, from on the ground security to air and behind the scenes. So we're looking forward to a really safe, secure, and celebratory Thanksgiving Day parade.
Fans of The Mandalorian will be thrilled to see a 3-story-high Baby Yoda for the first time as one of the more than a dozen character balloons. Protesters have returned to the streets of Khartoum, Sudan, to demand a return to civilian rule. NPR's Ada Peralta has more.
Protesters here in Khartoum are calling for full civilian rule. They're once again on the streets where they have set up barricades with cobblestones and burning tires. They say they reject a deal between the civilian prime minister of the country and the military. Their demands are clear. They want the military fully out of the business of running the country. Already, more than 40 protesters have been killed here, but they say they will stay on the streets until they get civilian rule. The prime minister is soft, they are chanting, but the streets are strong. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Khartoum.
Wall Street is closed for Thanksgiving. Overseas, UK and European shares were up. This is NPR.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Hannah Haynes. A 1,200-year-old canoe found in Madison's Lake Mendota has captured the nation's attention. Earlier this month, archaeologists from the Wisconsin Historical Society recovered a 15-foot canoe that dates back to 800 AD. They say it is the oldest intact canoe in Wisconsin, and state archaeologist Dr. Jim Skibo says he has never retrieved a canoe from such deep water. Crowds gathered to watch the recovery efforts at Shorewood Hills Beach.
You could feel, everyone there could feel, it was an emotional experience. And people even started crying and clapping. And, you know, it was really something to witness.
Skibo says the canoe likely belonged to ancestors of the Ho-Chunk, possibly the effigy mound builders. If it will take scientists 3 years to safely prepare the canoe for research or display in a museum. The University of Wisconsin-Green Bay is leading a project to restore rare oak savanna in northeastern Wisconsin. The university and its partners have invested in about $30,000 worth of seeds, with plans to return 76 acres back to the threatened habitat. Megan Hart has more.
On a sunny November afternoon, volunteers and students seeded parts of Weequahic Creek Natural Area that couldn't be reached by tractor.
We'll go in this direction. So,
oak savannas are open grassland with scattered trees. The scientists working on the project say the habitats are rare these days, but they can support a variety of wildlife. UW-Green Bay ecologist Bobby Webster says Wisconsin tribes helped cultivate the plant communities.
Especially in this part of Wisconsin, oak savanna is essentially the result of millennia of indigenous knowledge. These oak savannas wouldn't be here without the First Nations people and the way that they manage land.
After grasses and sedges begin growing on the former agricultural field, the university will plant oak trees. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Houses for sale in Wisconsin continue to move fast, but with a declining number of homes for sale, the market is starting to fall behind last year's record activity. The Wisconsin Realtors Association reported over 8,500 sales of existing homes in October. That was 12.3% lower than sales in October 2020. But economist David Clark says the second half of the last year was unusually strong, and there's still a significant rebound from the depressed sales in the first half of 2020.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Columbia Records, presenting Adele's new album, 30, featuring the single Easy on Me. Available now. More at adele.com. From Autism Speaks. Autism Speaks is working to create a world where all people with autism can reach their full potential. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Many Americans pull up a chair for a Thanksgiving feast today. Some who serve in the United States military may be struggling to pay for the food on the table. That may include somebody listening now. We've got a lot of people in the military who listen. Advocacy groups looked into this and estimated that about 160,000 military service members have trouble feeding their families. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke about this a week ago.
Our men and women in uniform and their families have enough to worry about. Basic necessities like food and housing shouldn't be among them.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is on this story. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
And happy Thanksgiving to you. How much of the military is 160,000 people and their families?
Well, it accounts for about 14% of the U.S. military, Steve, and roughly one-third of junior enlisted ranks, so the privates and corporals. And it seems to be getting a bit worse. COVID's a big reason. Many troops live off base. And as you know, rents have started going up during the pandemic. And also during the pandemic, there were a lot of job losses. So a spouse losing or having trouble finding work meant you had one income family trying to make ends meet.
Yeah, one income that could be $21,000 if you're a private. Even if you're a sergeant with years of experience, it might be $40,000, which is enough in some parts of the country, not nearly enough in other parts of the country. So what does the military plan to do about this?
Well, Secretary Austin has said he will temporarily increase the housing allowance troops get in more than 50 high-cost areas around the country to help troops make ends meet. We talked about that housing issue with Colonel Scott Pence. He's the garrison commander at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Let's listen.
It's toughest in those parts of the country that are high income. The Navy station in San Diego, our joint base Lewis McChord right outside of Seattle. They deal with different problems that we at Fort Bragg right outside of Fayetteville, North Carolina, don't deal with at such a high level. But we're also seeing rent levels go through the roof off post during this summer, which is forcing people into some short-term food insecurity situations.
And Secretary Austin also said in places with housing shortages, the Pentagon will extend temporary lodging expense reimbursement so families who are moving from one base to another will have a little more time to find a home. He wants also to make sure local commanders are keeping an eye on service members. Do they need the food bank or just basic help with family finances? Remember, these are mostly very young service members in their first job. And then he's also looking in the long term. He wants Pentagon officials to develop what he calls a roadmap to strengthen food security, and he wants answers in 90 days.
Is it hard for service families to keep those two jobs that a lot of families need to pay all the bills?
You know, it is because, of course, military families move every 3 years, so for so short a period, it's hard for a spouse, let's say, to get a job and then keep a decent job. So Secretary Austin is talking about extending a service member's time at a base to provide a little more stability.
What does Congress intend to do about this, if anything?
Well, service members who are struggling financially will likely see some help from Congress this year. There are amendments in the defense bills of both houses that will provide assistance to troops, creating a basic needs allowance for those families who are struggling the most, Steve.
Tom, thanks for the update. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman.
The origin story of America's Thanksgiving holiday imagines the pilgrims surviving harsh winters because of friendly Native Americans who taught them how to farm. Since then, indigenous peoples have had to adapt to the food system Europeans developed here. They often lack access to healthy foods, but there's a movement to preserve traditional farming practices. From member station KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona, Melissa Siveny reports.
At Coffee Pot Farms on the Navajo Nation, Sherilyn Yazzie starts the day with prayer.
Just pray and ask for a good day, for, you know, more rain if possible, but just for things to be healthy.
Ceremony and seed collecting are part of the seasonal rhythms of the off-grid farm. But Yazzie also uses non-traditional techniques, like hoop houses and a walk-behind tractor. She grows enough produce to feed 30 or 40 families.
It feels good. And then the other thing is when you see plants grow, it's just something you're like, wow, it's like magical every time you see a little seed come up. You're like, ooh, how you doing, little plant?
Yazzie studied to be a social worker, but she realized she couldn't convince people to eat healthy food if they didn't have access to it. The Navajo and Hopi Nations, home to nearly 200,000 people and larger than West Virginia, have just 15 grocery stores.
One of the things that I thought was, okay, well, if our ancestors were given from our holy people seeds that says, okay, you're going to grow your own food, you're given cattle or sheep, and you're supposed to be sustainable that way. How come we're not doing it?
Hopi chef Samana Tutsi says many traditional ways of growing and cooking food have been lost.
Not everybody has that privilege of being able to be that connected with their culture.
Today, she's teaching a class of Hopi and Navajo students in Flagstaff. She demonstrates how to turn a corn husk into a spoon.
The other thing you can use these for is making a brush.
Tutsi emphasizes cultures change and adapt to different technologies. The students roast sweet potatoes in a cob oven and boil corn tea in an aluminum pot.
To showcase what new technology can do with traditional knowledge is really amazing. So I wanted the kids to be able to appreciate that and be able to understand, you know, like, it's not a stagnant culture.
The kids make their own tea blends out of local plants like sage and juniper berries, plus a few things borrowed from other cultures like oolong and pineapple. This is Lexi Jacob, Lauren Tohi, and Trinity Begay.
I put in the sage and the cranberry.
I just like decided on like sage and the that grounded sweet corn.
This one is the black tea, and I'm going to put like a few cranberries in it.
16-year-old Najoni Black says her home on the Navajo Nation is 45 minutes away from a grocery store. She wants to learn how to grow more food for her family.
Knowing that beans can actually help the corn grow, like bringing nutrients into the ground, and the corn can use that to grow, I think that's one thing I brought back home.
Samana Tutsi hopes some of these kids will go on to be botanists or chefs. And by connecting with plants and with food, they connect with their cultures as well.
There's a spiritual aspect of it. You don't waste things. You're mindful about like every part of what you're using, so that way there's no waste. You know, you don't disrespect the earth, you don't disrespect the plant.
She says when you touch and taste the food, you're touching history. For NPR News, I'm Melissa Siviny.
Later today on All Things Considered, the Biden administration is trying to rebuild U.S. manufacturing capacity in the high-tech sector. That's making major chip makers in South Korea nervous that they'll lose business as a result. Listen to that story by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
Good morning. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Hannah Haynes. So nearly 9 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day. I'm a huge planner, so I planned my Thanksgiving meal like 2 weeks ago. But maybe you're a procrastinator and you're still open to a recipe idea for today. If so, NPR's got your back with a cranberry orange sauce recipe and preparation coming up in 10 minutes.
From virtual learning to remote working, high-speed internet has never been more important. Thanks to the Federal Emergency Broadband Benefit Program, you may be eligible for a significant discount. Funds are limited. Find out if you qualify and enroll at getemergencybroadband.org. WPR, PBS Wisconsin, and the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin are proud to bring you this message.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/WPR.
On Saturday morning, December the 11th at 11:15, join us for the WGTD Radio Theater's live broadcast from Lake Lawn Resort. We're featuring Carol Burnett and stars from her show. The Radio Theater, Saturday morning, December the 11th at 11:15.
Morning. There's a bit more morning edition just ahead. Checking the weather. It's going to be a chilly Thanksgiving day in Wisconsin, cool throughout the day with afternoon temperatures in the 30s, and breezy winds will continue today with gusts between 20 and 30 miles per hour. Tomorrow, temperatures will drop overnight. Frigid temperatures tomorrow in the morning, morning lows ranging between the upper single digits in the far north and the upper teens in the far south. Afternoon highs may struggle to reach the upper 20s to mid 30s across the state.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Klaviyo, working to help brands deliver personalized email and SMS campaigns that drive revenue and create genuine customer relationships at klaviyo.com/NPR. From TIAA, dedicated to helping people secure their financial futures with lifetime retirement income. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. At least 27 migrants have died while trying to cross from France to Britain in a small boat. Thousands of people have been trying to reach the UK to claim asylum, despite the efforts of French and British authorities to stop them. A number of people have died in the treacherous waters of the English Channel, but this is the worst incident since the crossings began more than 2 years ago. Reporter Rebecca Rossman joins us now from the French Channel port of Calais. Rebecca, thanks for being here. Just tell us what we know about what has happened.
So what we know is that around 2 p.m. yesterday, rescue workers got a call from a fisherman who said he spotted about 15 bodies floating in the water just off the coast of Calais. Rescue workers say they got to the scene within 15 minutes, but that the majority of victims were already dead. Prosecutors have opened an investigation to find out, you know, exactly what happened, but they think it, of course, has something to do with the fact that the victims were traveling in a tiny inflatable boat, and the boat was completely deflated when rescue workers arrived at the scene. Two people were saved. This morning, authorities identified the survivors as a Somalian and an Iraqi. They were immediately hospitalized and are being treated for severe hypothermia. France's interior minister spoke outside the hospital where they are being treated last night, however, and he emphasized that their condition remains critical.
It's a grim story, right? And so many of us remember hearing about these stories over and over again a couple of years ago, especially when it came to refugees out of Syria. But it's important to remember this is still happening, right? Can you tell us about the people who died?
We know that at least 17 victims were male, 7 were female, and this, sadly, it includes one woman who was pregnant. There were also 3 children among the dead. We don't know their exact nationalities, but French media is reporting that at least a handful were from countries in the Middle East. Many migrants trying to reach the UK in recent months include people from countries like Iraq and Afghanistan and Eritrea.
Why the desperation to reach the UK, Rebecca? I mean, you've talked to a lot of migrants in your wider reporting of this story, but they were in France, right? Like, France is a stable, peaceful place with social benefits for migrants and refugees.
Yeah, you know, I think, well, some of it just, first of all, it has to do with practical reasons, right? Many of these people, they already probably speak a certain amount of English, or they maybe have family in the UK that they're trying to reach. I also think perhaps there's this unrealistic sort of dream that life in the UK is somehow better, right? Like that there are more opportunities for them there, that it's easier to find work or get their paperwork in order. Many people have also told me they just don't feel welcome in France, not only because they don't speak the language, but also there's regular evacuations of migrant camps here in Calais. Human rights groups have accused police of harassing migrants in the area, slashing tents, restricting food or water for them. And they see the UK as a last resort. I spoke with a taxi driver here who told me he completely understood why these people want to go to the UK. He said that on a clear day, you can see the English coastline from here. So it's almost tangible for them, right? Many people have been traveling by foot for months, if not years, and this they see as their last frontier.
What are the two governments in France and the UK going to do to stop this from happening?
So there's been this sort of uncomfortable cooperation between the UK and France, where the UK tries to get the French government to keep people in France, paying over the summer. The UK government paid $73 million for France to double its number of patrols along the French coastline. And both governments are still in talks about joint patrols.
Okay. Rebecca Rossman, who's at the French Channel port of Calais, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hannah Haynes. Thanks for listening today. And on this Thanksgiving Day, we have special programming for you from 10 to noon. Morning Classics will include highlights from this year's Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concert, featuring performances by middle and high school students from all around the state. Be sure to tune into that.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community for 90 years, Piasecki Funeral Home.
3 weekdays. For our complete classical music schedule, including weekend and overnight offerings, visit WPR.org.
In sports, the Bucks continue their win streak, beating the Detroit Pistons last night. Score was 114-93. The Packers don't play today, but there will be 3 games to watch throughout the day. The Bears play the Lions at 11:30. Then the Raiders will play at Dallas at 3:30. And the night game is Bills versus the Saints. In the weather forecast, again, it'll be cold today. Afternoon temps in the 30s and breezy winds continue with gusts between 20 and 30 miles per hour. And there are some expected snow flurries this morning in certain parts of the state, but we do expect those to go away quickly and then have a drier rest of the Thanksgiving day.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King with some words of wisdom from Gucci Mane. If you ain't got sauce, then you're lost. It is not just good advice for life. It is an excellent philosophy in the kitchen as well. And we've got just the person to help you add the sauce to your Thanksgiving dinner. Jack Bishop is one of the hosts of the PBS TV show America's Test Kitchen. Jack taught me how to make a tangy cranberry sauce that puts the zing in amazing.
I've got a little bit of a twist with just really 2 ingredients that are going to make your cranberry sauce better than any cranberry sauce anyone at your Thanksgiving has ever had before.
Can I start with a confession?
Sure, I love a good confession.
This recipe calls for some liqueur. And much in the tradition, who was the one who would get sauced before she started cooking? Was it Julia Child? Well, I'm pulling a Julia.
Well, I mean, you know, you're like well past cocktail hour on whatever crazy schedule
you
work, right? I mean,
thank you, Jack.
In your world, it's what, like 9 o'clock?
It is. It's about 9 p.m. Yes.
So you should have been drinking 4 hours ago.
Who brought the sauce?
I brought the sauce.
Who made the sauce?
I made the sauce.
What's in the sauce?
I am the sauce.
Who brought the sauce?
Jack kept a close eye on me over Zoom. I was in my kitchen in Washington, D.C., and Jack gave me step-by-step instructions from Boston.
We need a medium saucepan, and we're going to put sugar, water, and salt in that saucepan. Most recipes, including the most back-of-the-bag recipes, don't add salt. Everything tastes better with a little bit of salt.
I'm going to grab my medium saucepan. I'm going to tell you, as I walk away from the mic, I recently moved. In this new place, I have an electric oven, and I don't like it as much. And I'm trying to determine if there are any benefits to an electric oven that will make me feel a little bit better about the fact that I no longer have my gas range, which I really loved.
I'm not going to sugarcoat it.
It's terrible.
Well, the oven itself, you know, let's separate the cooktop from the oven. The electric oven portion of the range actually works a little better than the gas. It's a little bit more consistent, the heating. The cooktop is just not going to be as responsive. Think about using 2 burners. So when you're making an omelet, start it over medium high, but then if you want to finish it gently, rather than turning that burner down, which isn't going to cool down, just move the pan to a cooler burner and have another burner set to like medium low.
That is a genius idea. Not something that had occurred to me, but would have saved me quite a few disasters over the past few months, honestly.
Awesome sauce in the morning. Awesome sauce at noon. Awesome sauce in my bubble bath. I pour some awesome sauce on you.
After the mixture of salt, sugar, and water came to a boil, we turned down the heat and added a bag of fresh cranberries.
You're basically cooking them until about 2/3 of them have popped. And you're just trying to pop enough of the berries to get enough pectin. You know, pectin is the thing that makes jelly wiggle.
Oh, they are popping, but they're not popping violently. They're just sort of popping open very gently.
Yeah, and you're going to get little bits of fruit in this wonderful sea of cranberry jelly.
Are cranberries, are fresh cranberries really only sold around the time of Thanksgiving, or have I just not been really paying attention?
They're really only available in the Thanksgiving time frame historically. Now, it's changed a little bit because they're now growing cranberries in South America and Chile. Cranberries are an American fruit. There are very few Native American fruits. There isn't a big tradition of growing cranberries in Europe, for instance, but it is, along with blueberries and Concord grapes, there are only three commercially grown fruits that are native to North America, and cranberries are one of them.
Next, I zested some orange peel.
I want to see your orange, by the way, because I want to see how good a job you did on zesting the fruit.
Oh, God, is it bad that I got down to the white part?
Well, so I see a little bit of fruit there. So you...
Yes.
You really went far.
I overzested.
There's no harm here, but the white part, the pith, has more of the bitter notes that are in the orange. The colored skin, and this is the same for lemons and limes as well, the colored part really has more of the floral aromatic notes. In general, that pith is a little bitter, and if you are zesting your fruit all the way down to the point where you see the actual fruit, you've gone too far. Now we're going to come with the thing that actually transforms this dish, which is 2 tablespoons of Grand Marnier.
My father was left at home to raise 3 small children, and he was a fella who often had a bottle of Grand Marnier not far from him, I think for some very explicit reasons. So I always have it in the house, just in case I need to chill. So I've got my tablespoon, I've got my Grand Marnier, and you tell me when it goes in.
So we want to do this at the end of the cooking process because we want to get the maximum impact from the Grand Marnier. I'm going to suggest you get pretty close to get the aroma because it's going to smell so wonderful when that Grand Marnier hits the hot cranberry sauce.
Here we go. I'm about to inhale. Hello, friends. Oh, God, that smells good. That smells delicious.
At this point, you cool the cranberry sauce. I like to put it into a container with a lid. You can spend a week in the fridge. I will say it's a good idea on Thanksgiving Day to take the cranberry sauce out of the fridge earlier in the afternoon and let it come back up to room temperature where it's just much more fragrant and delicious.
That's another very useful tip. Honestly, not something that had occurred to me, but that's a good one.
Oh, I want you to take a little taste. It's going to seem too loose because it's going to gel in the refrigerator, but tell me what it tastes like.
I can taste the orange and I can taste the orange liqueur. That is so good. The orange actually does change the game because this tastes like the cranberry sauce I have every year, except it has that added citrus jolt, which is really, really nice.
That burst of freshness along with the cranberries and the orange together is really going to cut the richness of the mashed potatoes, the green bean casserole, the gravy, all that heavy food. You need something bright and, of course, something colorful on the plate, and the cranberry sauce with orange is doing that.
Well, this is a strong recommend from me. I think I will be doing this one this year. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, Noelle. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Jack Bishop hosts the PBS TV show America's Test Kitchen. This is Morning Edition from NPR News, wishing you a happy and saucy Thanksgiving. I'm Noelle King.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR for you every hour, and there's always more news at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from Bader Philanthropies, celebrating November as Alzheimer's Awareness Month, thanking Alzheimer's and healthy aging nonprofit partners throughout the state of Wisconsin. Information is at Bader.org.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, presenting the return of the annual Holiday Pops Concert, Friday evening, December 3rd at Memorial Hall. The night will include holiday favorites and dinner and beverages that'll be available for purchase. For more information, visit RacineSymphony.org.
Points.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.